Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. A special new guest with me today on Church and Culture. Michael Greeny joins us here from Northern Virginia, not too far from me. One day we'll meet, I'm sure, if we haven't already. Michael has a wonderful new book out from TAN entitled 10 Battles Every Catholic Should Know. And I want to second that title, should know, should read, should own, after having read it today in one sitting. I did get up for food and things, but it's marvelously written, and it has a great impact on me, given the present-day ongoing struggles we have with the world of Islam, and particularly of Islamic terrorism. Michael, welcome to Church and Culture.
Oh, well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, did 9/11 have anything to do with you deciding to write this book?
Well, yes and no. It started out as a collection of articles that I had previously published, most of them in the Catholic Men's Quarterly. John Morehouse, the publisher of Catholic Men's Quarterly, is now the acquisitions editor at TAN Books, which is the publisher.
How convenient.
And I were what to do. Oh, and by the way, I'll put in a free plug for him. John did a marvelous job. He was great to work with. They should give him a raise.
I can tell myself by having dealt with him setting up this interview that he's very, very easy to work with and very knowledgeable. I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah. And but anyway, we were trying to figure out, what's a good project? Because he liked my writing, but what can we do that's in book form? So he thought that since I had published a number of these articles, a number of the chapters as articles in his magazine, which is now unfortunately defunct, that they would make a good book. So I looked back and saw what else I had done, much of which I had done prior to 9/11. And at that time, the military history journals didn't want to publish them because they said, we don't want to upset Muslims. You're coming down too hard on Muslims. I said, I thought I was trying to be objective and fair. But
you were. In fact, there's not a trace of Muslim bashing anywhere in the book.
Well, that's good because I had some genuine Muslims, one of whom was named Bob, say, I don't find anything offensive at all in this book.
No, there's nothing. It's history.
Yeah. In fact, the only negative comment I got was from someone in a Catholic Facebook group who said, I shouldn't be so mean to the Muslims. I said, did you actually read the book?
No. You always know when people haven't read a book, they say stupid things like that.
Of course. It's easier.
Well, I failed to mention to our listeners that you, although being a expert in the field of auditing and of employee stock ownership plans and have worked around the world, in fact, you worked in Egypt, so you obviously know something about that world firsthand.
Actually in Egypt. My associate, Dr. Norman Kurland, who's president of the Center for Economic and Social Justice, was the one on the spot there. But I did do the administration manual for the first ESOP ever developed in a developing country, which was the Alexandria Tire Company, which unfortunately is no longer a worker-owned, but it was still the first one.
Well, you have a fascinating vita, but you've written a great deal about Catholic matters and military matters and public policy matters and about issues of private ownership, which enters into your book when you talk about the demise of the Ottoman Empire, and particularly the weakening of its military. But we're going to get into that. Our listeners would be, I think, fascinated to get a kind of overview, because your first battle, Manzikert, takes place in 1071. Then you skip all the way to 1462, but at that point, the rest of the battles are almost sequential. Between Wallachia in 1462 with Vlad the Impaler, through to Cautín in 1621, you have almost a kind of, you know, domino effect.
Well, so, that was the, see, the original concept was just throw together a bunch of battles that are important, but not necessarily interrelated. And I thought, well, you know, the most boring history books I read in school were just the related facts and figures.
But of course, yes.
The major part of the word is story. And the easiest way to learn history is for somebody to tell you a story about it.
Absolutely.
So Manzikert got in there not because it was the first battle of the Crusades or the first one against Muslims or anything else like that, but because it basically started the whole conflict between the Ottoman Turks and the Byzantine Empire, which gradually, as it imploded, then they started moving into Eastern and Central Europe.
Well, let me ask you one very specific question before we get into Manzikert, which is, you know, four centuries in front of the next one at Wallachia. Were the Ottomans at Manzikert, were they Muslims?
Yes, they were.
Because you make a point later in that chapter that between Manzikert and Wallachia, with the surge of Islam, the soldiers became more ferocious.
Yeah, it was as if the character changed somehow. They were still Turks, they were Ottomans, but something changed in there.
But they were Muslims at this first battle.
Yes, definitely.
But something changed. Okay, so let's tell our listeners about why Manzikert is. You began by saying it sets up the struggle between the Byzantine Catholic, you know, empire and the Ottomans. So go ahead.
Yeah, the thing was that Manzikert need never have happened. The problem was that you had a rather minor engagement take place in Armenia near a rather minor fortress called Manzikert, and it was made a big issue of. And the new Basileus, which is what the last person to call himself emperor of Rome was Heraclius back in AD 610.
Not Heraclitus?
Heraclius. I may be pronouncing it wrong. I don't speak
Greek. It looked like the name of the Greek philosopher, but
no, no, this was the emperor Heraclius.
Yeah.
Heraclius.
Okay, you're just pronouncing the I as an E rather than I. Okay, Heraclius.
Yeah. Well, of course, my pronunciation is correct and yours is wrong.
Of course.
Because I'm the author.
Well, yes, absolutely. The customer is always right.
Yeah. Now, the problem was that Romanus Diogenes, the emperor who, in the 11th century, was at loggerheads with the state bureaucracy. There was a constant, conflict between the state bureaucracy and the military. And oddly enough, the military were more representative of the people. And this is one of the reasons why one of the historical footnotes I stuck in was the farmer's law of the Emperor Heraclius, which may actually not have been his law, but he's the one who seems to have really got it off the ground, which, to strengthen the army, made certain that ordinary people had land ownership. This way they could pay taxes and support a citizen army rather than hiring mercenaries. And Romanus Diogenes came pretty much at the end of that 400 years later, and most of his army was mercenaries. which were paid by the bureaucracy and controlled by nobles who had self-interested motives.
So how did it finally come to a conflict?
Well, they were negotiating for to get the Turks out of Manzikert, so they attacked, drove them off. But then, you know, instead of being able to mop up the Roman army, even though we would call them the Byzantines, they called themselves Romans, they decided to move in, and what should have been simply driving off the Ottomans, the Turks, they started advancing, got caught in the trap, which they still should not have been fatal, but through confusion among the mercenaries and betrayal by the rear guard, who was under the command of someone who wanted to be the emperor himself. Romanus Diogenes and his army were pretty much destroyed. This was after several days of desertions, some of whom actually seem to have gone over to the enemy.
One of the things I kept being struck by your book is how much soldier loyalty to the commander-in-chief plays a role in victorious battles.
Oh, definitely. I mean, morale can win a battle when nothing else can.
Yeah. So our side took a beating there.
Definitely.
And how long did it take for the Ottoman Empire to take down Constantinople itself?
Well, following Manzikert, when Romanus Diogenes was captured, the Ottoman Sultan Alp Arslan, I mean, that's a real tongue twister at times, realized that, you know, his real goal was not the Byzantine Empire. He wanted to go in and capture Egypt and add that to...
That's right. He had a fight going on with another Muslim leader.
Yeah, in Egypt.
Yeah.
He really didn't care about Byzantium. That's, you know, they're over there. We want Egypt because those are rival Muslims.
And they also have a lot of wealth in Egypt, right?
Oh, of course. Especially Alexandria and the most of the trade in the Mediterranean, that sort, went through either Byzantium or Alexandria. I mean, very rich part of the world. Until, you know, the discovery of the New World and the whole focus shifted to the West. Which is when places like these outlandish places like France and Spain and England came to the forefront. But what happened was that Alp Arslan figured it's safer for me to have a defeated emperor in place in Constantinople, whom I can turn my back on while I'm going to attack Egypt, than some new person who thinks he can defeat me and start another war.
So they didn't take Constantinople then. When did they finally get it?
1453.
Wow. Just before the next battle we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
In fact, why did it take them so long to take Constantinople itself?
Well, from what I've read from all the histories, and of those, John Julian Norwich's history, by the way, is
brilliant.
And it's terrific.
I just finished his book on the Four Princes a few days ago.
And you got me off track now.
Well, I was saying, why did it take almost four centuries after Manzikert for Ottoman Empire to include Constantinople?
Well, first of all, you know, the Byzantine Empire was still a very strong entity, and the only thing that really brought it down was treason. I mean, after Manzikert, what brought it down was the fact that Romanus Diogenes was assassinated. I mean, and then the bureaucratic party took control. And that, within a generation, a lot of the outlying areas in Asia had been taken over by the Ottomans. And then that just kept, you know, whittling away at the empire more and more, until finally pretty much all that was left was the city of Constantinople itself and a few outlying areas.
Of course, all those crusades that took place within those four centuries must have had something to do with protecting Constantinople to some degree.
Don't raise that with someone who is Greek Orthodox.
I know, because I know that the Latin Christians
really destroyed what was left of Constantinople.
On the fourth crusade, didn't they sack Constantinople itself?
Yeah. I kind of avoided getting into that because I figured, one set of enemies is enough.
Yeah. Okay, well, we can come back to that in a future show, but why did you pick up the thread with this encounter with Vlad the Impaler in Wallachia in 1462?
Well, because that was when the Ottoman threat became most evident to Europe. You know, going up, before that it had been pretty much just the story is covered by all the other crusades. Nobody ever seems to want to talk about the one that took place in Eastern and Central Europe. Everyone ignores it. It's as if it didn't happen. In fact, Vlad the Impaler and is only known by popular fiction and in an incredibly distorted way as Dracula.
Right.
Looking into it, well,
he's a Christian warrior hero.
Brave and quite a few other things. I'm not sure I would get into the heroic bit. He was pretty bloody.
But wasn't he heroic by the standards of his day?
Yeah. By the standards of his day, he was probably a little bit ferocious, but not quite as bad as the people he was actually fighting. The Turks are the ones who taught him all he learned.
Because he was their captive.
Yes, as was his brother, who pretty much became one of their puppets.
How does impaling actually happen? I have a hard time. I mean, you tell the story of the 20,000 Turks who were aligned along the road so that the Turkish invading army could see them. But what exactly is an impaling, and how does that work? Isn't that pretty labor-intensive to impale people?
I didn't look into it too closely because it kind of makes me uncomfortable for some reason. But as I understand it, you just get a very long, sharpened stake and thrust it under the rib cage and then hoist the person up on it and plant the pole in the ground.
I thought it was through the bowels.
It may have been. I wasn't going to. As I said, it kind of makes me clench my.
Aha! You have a hole in your research, and a hole in some part of the Turk's body. But he was pretty. That's one of your best chapters, Wallachia, because you describe the psychological strategy of Vlad up against a far larger contingent. And, vastly outnumbered contingent.
Yeah, because, see, the thing was, there is very little specifics about the actual, the order of battle and that sort of thing, so a lot of it has to be educated guesswork from the results and from what is told. So, but, to get at the real Dracula, Vlad the Impaler, you have to really look into, why would somebody even do this? And what about these contradictory reports? Do they even make sense? So to make sense of it, you have to put yourself in the place of someone like that and say, well, how was he thinking? How did he do it? And then see if it correlates with what he actually did and what other people think he was thinking and that sort of thing. It's not the easiest form of historical research, but it is the most fascinating.
Well, the efforts of Vlad did in fact result in Wallachia being an independent territory, albeit paying tribute to the Ottomans. Is that correct?
Yeah, a lot of the part of that was the fact that, so to speak, Dracula put the fear of God into them. But also, the Ottoman Empire had a very big problem in that it was extremely centralized. Virtually all power resided in the Sultan. And that meant that the further away you got from Constantinople, or Istanbul as it later became to be called, the further you were from the Sultan's control. it wasn't too unusual for a very successful general to come back and then find himself executed.
Yeah, you make that point with the, especially with the death of Suleiman the Magnificent.
Oh yeah,
and his successor, who
Selim the Drunk,
was so weak that this centralized power that was required for the empire to flourish simply was taken away.
Yeah. Well, no, the centralized power remained. It was just that it was administered very poorly.
Doesn't that weaken the?
Yeah.
You say it led to the decline of the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, I mean it's what always happens with the leader principle. You take out the leader on whom everything is centered, and everything falls apart. You saw that, for instance, in Nazi Germany. The Führer was everything. And if you got too powerful or something else, you got removed. Or you were disappeared.
Well, Stalin's even a better example.
That too.
I mean, they disappeared by the thousands. Even his closest associates during, you know, the post-Lenin days.
Oh, yeah. And I think Warren Carroll, you know, the historian who was president of Christendom College,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
His contention was that Stalin poisoned Lenin.
Wouldn't surprise me at all. I hope he did. But, you know, I mentioned Suleiman the Great, or the Magnificent, who...
Or the Lawgiver, or a number of other epithets.
He is the central figure behind the third battle that took place in Hungary in 1526, which really begins the domino effect through Vienna and Malta and then finally Lepanto. That was a total victory of the Ottomans over the, by then, these were Latin Catholics, correct, in
yes.
Hungary? Because the schism is now 5 centuries old, and you have this strong delineation between the Orthodox Church and the Latin Church. So these Hungarians, why were they so badly trampled at, give me the pronunciation of this place again.
Mohács.
At Mohács, which is, that's in central Hungary, is it? It's south of Budapest?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's on the road to Budapest, which was called Buda then, which Suleiman the Magnificent, the head of the Ottoman Empire, eventually captured.
Yeah.
I mean, so what happened at Mohács?
A place on the other side of the river. Pardon, what was that again?
What happened at Mohács?
Oh, yeah. Well, what you had was a bunch of nobles and knights who were, as they say, armored from head to foot and from ear to ear. There was one way to fight the enemy, and they knew what it was. You all get together in one big bunch, and you charge, and you crush them. Well, unfortunately, if you're going to have a cavalry charge with extremely heavy cavalry, and an armored knight is very heavy cavalry, you don't pick swampy ground.
Huh.
And you also don't dismiss your artillery, especially when the enemy has some of the most advanced artillery.
Yeah, they left all the artillery in the very rear. I didn't understand that. And there wasn't much of it.
No, there was not. If they had waited a few days and picked better ground, they might have won.
Kind of like Lee at Gettysburg.
Well, not quite. Lee at least knew what he was doing most of the time, except for that final charge.
He didn't pick the right ground at Gettysburg, but that's another story.
Yeah, well, actually, the ground wasn't picked at all.
So the ground here picked at Mohács, and was it out of pride that the who was leading the Catholic army then?
King Louis. But he was a very young man.
And he chose not to wait for reinforcements.
Right. Because he was a king. His nobles assured him that they were going to win, that nothing could defeat an army of Christian knights charging down on these incompetent savages known as Muslims and Turks. Well, yeah, but these savages were armed with heavy artillery, advanced infantry, and much better weaponry than the Christians by this time. And they also arranged their order of battle much more intelligently. In other words, you put the artillery out where it can do some damage first, And then you get the Christian knights, after they're dumb enough to charge, into a crossfire. And after you've decimated them, then you send in your infantry and just clean up everybody else. Which is,
and everyone died, including Louis II.
Yes.
And really, he had a very large reserve of an army a day or two away, correct? Or was that army deliberately slowing down so as not to get there?
That depends on who you're talking to. There were two basic parties in Hungary at that time, and the other party, the leader of the other party, was in charge of the reserves that were coming up. And so he may have delayed in order to give his party a victory, because he ended up being the Sultan's puppet.
What's his name?
Okay, that would be John Zapolya, Voivoda, or a leader of Transylvania. Voivoda was a local, sort of like a duke or a count or something. And so he was coming up, but as to whether he was deliberately delaying or was just naturally late is a matter of opinion, depending on who you're talking to.
Well, we're going to come back to these 10 battles that every Catholic should know, recently published by TAN, written by Michael Greeny, who's on the phone. We'll be back after this short message.
Don't miss Al Cresta speaking on the topic, The Debt the World Owes the Catholic Church, on Thursday, February 15th at 7 p.m. at St. Francis of Assisi Church in Ann Arbor. This is a great way to kick off the Lenten season with an inspiring look at how Jesus has been operating through his church over the centuries to bless the human race. That's Thursday, February 15th at 7 p.m. More details at stfrancisa2.com.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Our topics during Cresta in the Afternoon toggle between church teaching and then using that teaching to shine a light on our world. We'll look at Christ and culture, church and world, religion and public life, from abortion to Zechariah and everything in between. Biblical criticism, Hollywood productions, academic debate, family and love, prayer and spirituality.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
No one likes to get angry, but sometimes we can't help it. Anger is a God-given response to injustice that's supposed to motivate us to address the problems we encounter. Of course, wrath is one of the deadly sins, but anger isn't always sinful. It all depends on what you do with it. For instance, anger is righteous, even godly, if it causes us to make an appropriate, proportionate, and productive response to an injustice. Alternatively, anger becomes sinful if it causes us to lash out in ways that are inappropriate, disproportionate, or unproductive. Be careful to not let your anger add to the injustice. To learn how to manage anger and all your passions more gracefully, check out my book, Broken Gods, Hope, Healing, and the Seven Longings of the Human Heart. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
I'm back with Michael Greeny, who we're discussing his marvelous new book from TAN, 10 Battles Every Catholic Should Know. We're not going to get through all 10 because there's such rich discussion in all of them. So, but we are now to the famous Battle of Vienna of 1529, which was the culmination of Suleiman the Great attempt to conquer Vienna, the heart of Europe. It was his lifelong dream. What happened? Did Suleiman... was he able to fulfill his dream or not, Michael?
Well, fortunately for Western civilization, no. Not that he didn't try. But the Siege of Vienna in 1521 was probably his best effort. And oddly, one of the main things that helped defeat him was the fact that the whole Holy Roman Empire was almost broke. And the defenses of Vienna were in terrible shape. So what did they do instead of putting up expensive stone walls? They said, "What? We got to do something. I mean, Suleiman the Magnificent is on his way, and he is all conquering." So they said, "Well, let's just throw up some dirt walls and see if that does anything." This changed Western warfare.
Wow.
Because it turned out that earthworks were superior to stone walls. And when you throw up...
Why is that? You would think high stone walls would be the hardest thing to breach.
Well, first of all, it doesn't take a genius to design a pile of dirt. And you don't need a good architect. All you need is someone with a little common sense and a lot of people to dig and carry dirt. And then you throw them up, and you find out something unusual. If you try to mine a pile of dirt, you know, to mine, you dig a tunnel under it, put a lot of gunpowder or other explosives under it, light a fuse, run away, and hope that it blows up and makes a big hole in the defenses. Well, if you're trying to do that to earthworks, it doesn't work very well. You might get a big bunch of dirt flown a few hundred yards, but it's almost child's play to fill that in again, even before the people who are trying to breach the defenses can bring up their troops.
And the main tactic of the Ottoman army in a siege mode was to dig wide trenches directly toward the walls, or in this case, earthworks, and dig tunnels under as far as, once they got to the end of the open trench, to start digging mines under where they couldn't be seen and then blow up the walls.
Correct? Right. And then through the breach in the walls or the defenses, go charging in, screaming, yelling, waving your swords and muskets and that sort of thing.
And what happened at Vienna? Did this not work?
No, it didn't. They found out that it didn't work very well against earthen walls. The earthen walls also had an additional advantage. There are three types of cannonballs you throw at an enemy. Solid shot, which are intended to batter down a wall. Marble shot, and marble, you know, the stone marble that you carve statues out of, which, you know, breaks into a million pieces and acts like shrapnel. And then anti-personnel of another type called grape shot, which is just basically musket balls packed into bags and then fired as if they were cannonballs. Well, what happens is that with earthen walls is that the marble shot is ineffective. It doesn't do anything. The grape shot is dissipated before it gets to the wall, and the solid shot buries itself in the earth, making the wall stronger.
This was discovered, like Thomas Edison, just by accident, out of sort of...
By complete accident, simply because they had no other...
No time to build stone walls.
Yeah. They couldn't afford them, and they didn't have time even to get the architects and the engineers building them. So what they did was just mobilize the population, say, put up some earthen walls.
Now, how were they able to, even with these earthen walls, withstand this, I think it was a 300,000 person army that then began to siege Vienna that had far less people, much less soldiers inside?
Well, the problem is that the advantage is always on the defender's side. And another bad part was of the, as you point out, the Turks' method of siege warfare was to drive a trench straight at the walls. Well, that means that anybody up on the wall can start shooting at you and just pick off people by the thousands. The Europeans...
But weren't they throwing their own Christian captives and slaves into the trench to build it, to dig it out? And so the Catholics inside Vienna were actually shooting their own.
Yeah, in a sense. But you didn't really have too much of a choice, because these people were being driven to it but with the whips and chains and everything else. I mean, for the enslaved people doing the grunt work of digging this trench, it was either dig or die, and pretty much it was dig and die. And unless the Christians on the wall wanted to be overcome by the Turks in the trenches, they had to shoot their own people.
Probably they were going to die anyway.
Yeah. They were either going to die trying to drive a trench at the walls, or die trying to run away from digging a trench at the walls.
So why did Suleiman and his great military commander, Pasha. Why did they decide to finally just give up and go home?
Well, it was starting to get toward the end of the year. And now you're talking about people who were accustomed to the rather mild climate of the Near East. Bright and sunny most of the time, not very cold. And if you've ever been spent any time in Germany or Austria or Central Europe, you know that they have one thing that the Near East often lacks, which is nice deep snow and long cold winters, which make even campaigning for the Western armies very difficult. Do you remember the scene in Patton where Patton is, there's a voiceover where he says the Germans haven't tried a winter campaign since Frederick the Great, and so I think that that's what they're going to do, because campaigning in winter, even for people accustomed to winter, it's terrible.
So in other words, desert, but when they went back to Constantinople, didn't they claim a victory?
Of course. You have to put a little spin on these things.
Even though they never got inside the walls of Vienna.
No. I mean, true, the Sultan was a total despot. In theory, total power. But if the market rabble decided they didn't like him, he wasn't going to be Sultan for very long. So no matter what happened, you had to sell this thing as a great victory.
Now, Suleiman was also the, you don't call him emperor, you call him Basileus?
Basileus, yeah.
For the famous battle at Malta. And as it turns out, I mean, he lost there too, against, again, a case of huge naval and infantry forces against a relatively small group perched up the hills of Malta.
Yeah, and that was so unusual and so unexpected that they thought it was a miracle. I mean, here you had one of the finest equipped armies in the world, you know, that of the Ottoman Turks. 60,000 of the finest soldiers in the world against a couple of thousand knights, men-at-arms, and, oddly enough, the Maltese themselves. They didn't want the Turks in there either. If it had not been for each one of those elements, the siege of Malta would have gone very much differently.
And what was the strategic importance of the island of Malta for Suleiman the Magnificent?
It's a stepping stone to Europe. If you look at a map, it's like maybe 50 or 60 kilometers from Sicily. And Sicily was the key to Italy, of course. I mean, Hannibal, you know, the Carthaginian general, that was his first objective, until he went up through Spain and then crossed the Alps with his elephants and killed off most of them and that sort of thing. But if you can capture Malta, and, I mean, they were trying this during the Second World War. The place was under continuous bombardment by the Nazis. They wanted that island. It was held by the British by them. If you can get Malta, it's practically a stone's throw to Sicily. If you've got Sicily, you've got Italy.
Now, if we go back, though, historically, when the Islamic movement began in the 7th century, they very quickly conquered the Middle East, Northern Africa, into Spain. How much of Spain did they eventually occupy?
Well, probably about 95% of it. There was just a tiny little splinter up in the Pyrenees, the Asturias.
So in the memory of the Islamic peoples, their presence in Europe is something that had been a reality for several centuries already.
Oh, yes, and they were also in southern France.
That's, and parts of Italy.
Yes. They held Sicily for a while.
And they were driven out of Spain in 1300s, is that correct?
Well, the final expulsion, the final victory against the Moors was in 1492.
Okay, not till then. This is really just only a few decades before the battles we're talking about.
Right.
So they're actually trying to reclaim an arena of influence where they have been present for centuries, many centuries.
Yeah. In fact, it was only the fact that you know, Ferdinand and Isabella managed to get the Moors out of Spain entirely in 1492, that caused them to listen to some fellow named Christopher Columbus when he came up with this crazy idea and said, hey, now that you've finished this job, wouldn't you like something else?
Well, that's, you know, and there's another miracle there. Malta had a hero. Tell our listeners about this great knight who led the defense of Malta. Quite a story there.
You mean the Grand Master, Jean
de Lattes? Yes.
Oh, yes. Tremendous soldier. He had been at the Siege of Rhodes when they were thrown out of there. That was a negotiated victory. The Sultan was not happy about having to negotiate a truce at Rhodes that let the knights go because they were a thorn in his side forever. The Muslims did not care for the Knights of Malta for some reason.
Yeah, they were able to conquer the knights. Well, it was really a surrender, amicable surrender, and the knights, they were called hospitallers.
The Knights Hospitallers of St. John of Jerusalem,
yeah,
and Rhodes.
They then went from there to Northern Africa and eventually ended up on the island of Malta. They were not yet called the Knights of Malta, were they?
Not at that time. Actually, I'm not sure when that became official.
Probably sometime after this spectacular battle.
It was the Knights Hospitallers of St. John of Jerusalem. And then later came and of Rhodes and of Malta. And then they lost Malta in 1798 to the British. Or maybe it was Napoleon.
What was the key to the Knights being able to defend Malta against such overwhelming forces?
Well, basically, it was military stupidity on the part of the Islamic forces, the Turks. You had two, they split the command, which was not very smart. You had two people trying to carry out a military operation to gain political power. And how they did it meant that the fellow who was the sea pasha, the admiral, wanted the land pasha, the general, to do all the work, and he would take all the credit, whereas, of course, the land pasha wanted the sea pasha to do all the work so that the land pasha could take all the credit. And so they spent most of their time arguing. And when they had the chance to breach the walls of the capital, they picked the wrong place. And then they went after, then they decided right in the middle of beginning the siege of the capital itself, they decided, oh no, this is a bad idea. Let's go besiege this little tiny castle called St. Elmo's. Well, that was a big mistake. First of all, St. Elmo's had absolutely no strategic value whatsoever. They could have easily gone around it, ignored it completely. Instead, they spent 3 months trying to reduce this tiny little nothing castle, which kept getting reinforced from the capital itself. And in the middle of the siege, someone who actually knew what he was doing arrived from Constantinople, called them all idiots, and said, you've wasted your time, but now that we're committed to it, we have to take it, or we'll look really bad to the Sultan and to everybody else. And so they finally took St. Elmo, and then... And the battle was so bloody and so costly that one of the pashas said, if the son has cost us this much, what will the father take? Because he was looking at these huge walls at La Valette.
They kind of knew that it was over.
Well, they knew it was over, but they weren't going to quit then. They carried on for quite some time. And a couple of times they almost got in to the city. I mean, you're talking a few... 1,000 knights at most, and a few, well, actually, no, it was a few hundred knights at most, and a few thousand men-at-arms, reinforced by Maltese irregulars who would nip in and do whatever damage they could whenever they could.
So, as important as this Battle of Malta was in 1565, skipping over a couple of really interesting battles that our listeners probably know less about. You told me, though, that it's the Battle of Lepanto in 1571 that is the most significant battle of the 10 you describe in your book. Now, why is that?
That's because, I'll give you the punchline first. It broke the back of Turkish sea power forever. And unfortunately, the fact that the Holy League that St. Pius V put together could not hold itself together, that were made so that they could not follow up on it. But the Turks were no longer a serious threat at sea after Lepanto. What you had was everybody needed to stop the Turks. Catholic, Protestant, even the Jews were in on this. Everybody hated the Turks. Even other Muslims hated the Turks.
Now, where is Lepanto located on the map?
It's the Gulf of Corinth. It's to the east of Italy and to the west of Greece, somewhere.
So is it in the Adriatic?
Yeah. Yes.
And is Lepanto an island or a city?
It's a gulf.
It's a gulf.
The Gulf of Lepanto.
And how were the forces lined up against each other? Were they of equal strength, or was one outnumbering the other?
Yeah, they were approximately of equal strength. The problem for the Allies, the Holy League, was that you had so many different groups in there that command was a problem. This was solved by they picked the one person who was acceptable to everyone, Don Juan of Austria, whom the English insist upon calling Don Juan, which really kind of grates my teeth.
Of course, because of Byron.
Yeah. But now, oddly enough, even though in theory the Turks were under a single commander, what you had was a lot of people with self-interested motives who were in there for what they could get. There was a Christian renegade, Occhiali, and at one point, he actually could have won the battle for the Turks, but he decided to save as much of his own ships as he could because it was his own money invested.
Once again, a lack of loyalty to the commander.
Yes. Everybody was loyal to Don Juan of Austria.
There had been so much bad karma built up over the centuries with the Ottoman Empire. It almost seems like it, and you describe so many times in the book where, you know, an ally did not promise aid and didn't come or wouldn't even promise aid. Here you have everybody who promised to be there, show up, unite, not quarrel with each other over, you know, the goodies afterward. Whereas on the other side, on the Ottoman side, that's where you had the lack of unity.
Right. And the moment the lack of unity, the moment that solidarity and morale broke down, so did the war effort.
And why is Lepanto then so commemorated in Catholic lore tradition, such as the great Chesterton poem? Does Lepanto deserve that?
I think so, yes. Because it was a turning of the tide. All of a sudden, people realized that far from being, having an occasional victory, which left the Turkish forces almost completely intact, I mean, even at Malta, yes, they lost an enormous number of soldiers, but they still had many more to draw on. You had the wealth of the Ottoman Empire to draw on. At Lepanto, you had the entire Turkish navy almost totally destroyed. It was considered a miracle. In fact, it is said, and I can't verify this, but I repeated it in the book, that St. Pius V was praying and having everyone else, of course, pray for victory. And it is said that at the moment that the victory was clearly won, he rose and declared a Te Deum be celebrated. I mean, people went nuts over this. I mean,
did Henry VIII's navy show up at this?
No, this was Queen Elizabeth I.
This was after Henry, okay.
Oh, definitely.
And did Elizabeth send... I know that Elizabeth...
She sent aid. She may have sent ships. My memory's a little vague on that, but she definitely ordered that a service of commemoration and thanksgiving be celebrated in all the churches in England.
Who was the most responsible for the victory at Lepanto?
The credit is given mostly to Don Juan, but he was acting under the advice of, you know, some very smart people. But unlike many leaders in history, he actually took their advice. And one of the smartest things he did was, you know, for 2,000 years, a standard feature of warfare in the Mediterranean was that you had your galley fitted out with a ram. The method was you get up to ramming speed, which if you've seen Ben-Hur, you know what that means. You ram the enemy, then you go charging over and board them if you haven't sunk them already. Well, what the galleys at the Ponto had was gunpowder. You had cannons, which meant that if you could get some of that weight off the ship, you could maneuver better. You didn't have to come to grips, you know, side by side with the enemy in order to fight the battle. You could stand off and use your cannon. So Don Juan ordered that all the rams be unshipped. This made the ships faster, lighter, and ride higher in the water. And it's much easier to aim down at a ship than it is to aim up, so that the Christian gunners had a much better target than the Turkish gunners.
And did the Turkish ships have the rams on them?
Oh, yes. They kept them, and they tried to use them, but they were not very effective simply because the Christians could move faster out of range. Now, there was also another innovation that was on the Christian ships, boarding nets. These had never been employed on any scale before. A boarding net is it's a net, obviously, but it's spread out around the sides of the ship, so that it's basically a fence keeping people in, or keeping people out actually, and your soldiers and sailors can get through the net onto the enemy ship, but they have a much more difficult time trying to get back onto your ship.
You know, it's interesting that. Didn't the Ottomans themselves have a reputation for innovation in battle themselves?
Not really. They were kind of hidebound. They had developed their methods of warfare over the centuries, and it was very hard to change them.
Is that because of that? You talk about a elite group of soldiers that were really slaves. They were never allowed to marry.
The Janissaries.
Very interesting story of the Janissaries. This kind of elite professional army that for centuries grew in power and grew in ability. But they don't come into play in a naval battle, do they?
I did not see any references to them. I'm assuming that they were all land troops. What you had at Lepanto were mostly Marines, you know, Marine soldiers, and the sailors themselves.
Well, given the impact of this battle, you know, on the heels of Malta and on the heels of Vienna, why is it that it took till World War I for the Ottoman Empire to crumble?
Well, part of the problem was that although the Holy League that came together did manage to win the victory at Lepanto, it did not hold together and was not able to follow up on, you know, on its victory. If you really want a war, then you have to keep on going. Nothing succeeds like success, especially in warfare. But they fell out, and all the European countries started fighting among themselves, the Catholics against the Protestants, the Protestants and Catholics against the Jews, the Germans against the French against the Italians against the Spaniards. Everybody hated everybody. And the person that they hated most, the Turk, seemed to be contained for a while. But then, of course, he came back because they were not able to follow up. And, frankly, the Ottoman Empire was huge. And it had enough inertia to keep it going at least till 1918 when it officially collapsed. Its glory days were probably gone by the time of Napoleon.
And when Napoleon invaded Egypt.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Michael, you're going to have to come back. We've run out of time, and I will invite you back very soon. We're going to talk more about this and related matters. And I want to remind our listeners, as one person on the dust jacket says, a tour de force, which I agree, 10 Battles Every Catholic Should Know by Michael D. Greeny from TANT. Beautiful book, too. Great cover.
Oh, yeah.
Great production. Great pages. fact, it's very readable. I recommend my listeners get this. And Michael Greeny, will you come back in the future and talk more about it?
Oh, definitely.
We'll have you back. And to all of you, you're listening, we'll have another great guest after this short message.